Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
On March 17th, everyone is a wee bit Irish. Parades, shamrocks, leprechaun outfits, you get it. They're all representative of St. Patrick's Day. But what about the corned beef and cabbage? We'll speak with Irish-American cookbook author Margaret Johnson today for her views on the food, past and present, today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. Indeed, the patron saint of Ireland, St. Patrick, he lived in the 5th century in Britain and Ireland and is credited with bringing Christianity to Ireland and probably responsible in part for the Christianization of the Picts, a tribal people of what is now Scotland, and the Anglo-Saxons. Irish immigrants in America began celebrating the saint's feast day even before the town of Dublin, as far as parades go. In the 1700s, there was the very first parade in Boston in the mid-1700s. And then, of course, New York followed shortly thereafter, later in 1760s, I believe. And New York boasts the largest parade in the U.S., 150,000 marchers and 2 million spectators. And what might surprise a lot of people is that this large parade is followed, number two, by Savannah, Georgia, whose parade started in the early 1800s, and they now have a week-long cultural festival preceding the holiday. I guess the parade just kind of lost sight of what it was all about, and so they devoted an entire week-long cultural festival. And I've not been, but it sounds wonderful. Indeed, there's no shortage of St. Patrick's Day celebrations throughout the country. Smaller towns that you wouldn't imagine have parades and go out in force to celebrate this. It's a fun celebration and a fun holiday. And it's really no wonder, because last census that we got, that I saw that had a separation, 2011 U.S. Census, about 34.5 million people in the United States claimed Irish heritage. That's more than 7 times the population of Ireland itself. But what about the food? And indeed, the food that accompanies not the Irish food, but the food that we associate with Ireland and the food that we usually find on this day in the United States. My guest today can definitely talk about that and define some of our associations and where they came from. Margaret McGlue Johnson grew up in Massachusetts in a typical Irish-American family. Both sets of grandparents and great-grandparents were born in Ireland, so talks and tastes of the old country always played a major role in her life. She finally visited Ireland in 1984 and was hooked. From that year forward, the former English and journalism teacher decided that her love of cooking and passion for Ireland would be her life's work. She's the author of 11 cookbooks, including the Flavors of Ireland series, Tea and Crumpets, and the Irish Pub Cookbook, to name a couple. Her food, she has written for a lot of food and travel magazines, both here in the U.S. and in Ireland. And she has a website called theirishcook.com. So it is with great pleasure and anticipation that I welcome Margaret Johnson. Welcome, Margaret.
Well, thank you for having me.
I did hear you speak into a presentation several years ago on one of your books, and it was the, you'll have to help me out, I don't have the title in front of me, The Puddings and the Tarts and the...
Oh, right. Irish Puddings, Tarts, Crumbles, and Fools.
Oh, it was terrific and delicious, I might add.
Oh, thank you.
And I had read in an interview recently that you did, a couple of years ago, that our beloved corned beef and cabbage is really an American interpretation of an Irish dish. Can you expand on that a little bit?
I can. It's something I practically have it memorized because it's something that comes up pretty much all the time. I do a lot of programs in public libraries and for Irish American cultural groups and so on, and events similar to the one where we met, and it is... A big question. And I do have a little something that I can simply read. I won't read the entire history, but it starts with the fact that corned beef and the word corn actually refers to the coarse grains of salt that beef was cured in Ireland. Mm-hmm. However, that beef did not stay in Ireland. It was exported from places like Cork and Dublin, where people could afford it. And unfortunately, in Ireland, most people could not afford it because it obviously the Irish population was somewhat poor, I would have to say, as I guess we all can relate to that. So anyway, cows, if they were owned at all, they were raised predominantly for their dairy products. So corned beef was exported. Now, fast forward to the U.S., and when so many Irish immigrants came here, they did find something that was similar to their bacon, boiling bacon, which was also a cured pork. And that's what the Irish used to eat, would be bacon and cabbage, not corned beef and cabbage.
Ah.
When they came here, they found that many people were eating brisket, which was also boiled the way that their bacon was boiled, and served with potatoes and cabbage and so on. So it really came to be that the Irish discovered corned beef here in America with many of their immigrant neighbors, including many of their Jewish neighbors who were boiling brisket. You know, brisket is a very popular cut of beef and very popular in kosher cooking. Mm-hmm. So that is the basis from my understanding, and it's one of those things, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, it sounds good to me, and it makes for good radio. And it's true that I've had many Irish cooks as guests on my show, and mm-hmm. and they've always, said, well, we don't eat corned beef and cabbage. Oh, now they do, but that was not something that was traditionally, you wouldn't find it in Ireland.
No, not at all. And I also add this to my little presentations that I give. I did grow up in Massachusetts, as you pointed out, and we ate corned beef and cabbage a lot, not only on St. Patrick's Day. We ate it, sometimes we might even have it for Easter. I mean, it wasn't necessarily a holiday meal to us. And, of course, in Massachusetts and parts of New England, it's called a New England boiled dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And corned beef, again, would be the brisket that my family would buy from the local butcher, who would corn his own in a very simple brine of 7 cups of water to 1 cup of salt. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave a presentation yesterday, as a matter of fact, and I saw the people in the audience scurrying to write that down. And I said, it's not that hard. 7 cups of water, 1 cup of salt, you put the brisket in for 24 hours, drain the water, et cetera, and then cook it the next day. So it was a very mild cure and probably similar to the flavor of bacon, even though I know pork and beef have, of course, completely different tastes. But when it's boiled like that in a very simple brine, it has a very similar taste.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned something that, that they couldn't, the cows were raised for dairy, the beef was raised for dairy cows. And the immigrants coming to this country were all, you know, quite poor, particularly in the early 1800s during the time of the potato famine. So you think about it, a boiled dinner like that with cabbage, a big head of cabbage, which was always available and relatively cheap, you know, that could feed a lot of people over a number of days. So
a lot of people.
Yeah.
And also it was the same way that Irish stew is one of those slow cooking, long cooking ways to get the best that you can out of maybe a cheap cut of meat.
Mm-hmm.
And you could put it over the fire, over the hearth very easily. So it was just that method of cooking also that was very conducive to that type of food.
Right. And of course, you know, not that the Irish were the only ones who did that, but it's always attributed to Irish cooking of the poorer cuts of meat that were cooked for a long time, and particularly lamb, mutton, right?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mutton is not eaten quite as much any longer, but lamb is very, very, very popular. It's probably, I would say, the most popular meat in Ireland. And now it's lambing season, and that, of course, is what brings us to eating, you know, a lot of lamb at, you know, the Easter time
and, uh-huh.
in the spring. So
right. Interesting. Well, these Irish who came to America, as I mentioned, were primarily very poor, mm-hmm. did a lot of jobs, almost, you know, like equivalent to the slave population, where they did so many jobs that were harsh work, were owned by their owner, by the, you know, the landowners, work that other people didn't want to do. So the food was very basic, the food and the cooking was very plain. I guess that's the long-held impression that many people have of Irish food and Irish cooking, and we can dispel some of that later on in the show. But what about some of the other dishes that we associate with Ireland, Irish people, and certainly St. Patrick's Day? Soda bread, for instance.
Yes, soda bread. That's the topic that I deal with in these presentations I've been doing this month. I call it the sweet side of Ireland, and I use soda bread as the genesis of some other sweet dishes that we have. Now, soda bread in Ireland is the traditional brown soda bread, which a lot of Americans, they've never eaten.
Mm-hmm.
They have no idea. They think that when you say soda bread, it's the sweet cake-like soda bread that is on every in every bakery and in every supermarket bakery this time of year.
Often studded with raisins or something.
Yes, you know? Raisins, right. And caraway seeds.
Right.
Yes, that was originally called spotted dog. And it was a sweet cake. It had a couple of other names. One was Kearney cake. I don't know the origin of that name. But that's what, again, Americans associate with soda bread. So I make a brown soda bread, which has just four ingredients, and I show them the ingredients. Just buttermilk, baking soda, salt, and flour.
Mm.
And those were all simple ingredients. There was no yeast because yeast just did not work well with the very fine, finely milled Irish flour. So that soda bread is often very foreign to Americans. They don't get it. But, of course, if you go to Ireland, that's, you know, from your breakfast basket of breads right through to lunch and dinner, you're going to be offered that brown soda bread. So I show people that, and I make a loaf, and they taste it, and it's a revelation. And then I move on to the sweeter one, which is the more commonly found here.
Mm-hmm.
And then I do a couple of little desserts also that have some other ingredients in it, like oatmeal, make these little cakes with Guinness in them and so on. So I try to show the evolution of the soda bread. But that was a simple four-ingredient recipe, and it also could be cooked over the hearth, cooked in a cast iron skillet or on an iron. It was called a Harron iron, and it was a kind of a grate that you could put not over the fire but next to the fire so that the heat would bake it. So these are some, you know, traditions that have evolved into some of the things that we eat now and right. we do associate so much with Ireland.
Well, it's interesting because when the potato finally made it from the New World to Ireland, people are always astounded when, you know, one tells them that no, potatoes didn't originate in Ireland, even
right.
though they think they did. They're a New World food, and they made it to Ireland, and the Irish, went with it, and they farmed a lot of potatoes till there was a virus, I guess, that set in.
Yeah, it was blight. Yeah,
the blight. Right. But many of the dishes that they do give us from, their wonderful love of potatoes and use of potatoes have made it to America and are associated with the Irish and are made quite frequently here, including, of course, mashed potatoes, any mashed potato dish, shepherd's pie and colcannon.
Mm-hmm.
The shepherd's pie in particular, I mean, just the name, draws up images of a shepherd sitting by on the hillside. But I would assume that that was originally made with lamb.
Yes, and that is another misnomer that I try to correct. It is shepherd's pie is a dish that should be made with ground, or they call it minced lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Cottage pie is the ground beef or minced beef version.
Mm-hmm.
All the other ingredients are exactly the same. And probably, I'm going to say 75 to 80% of everyone who makes a shepherd's pie makes it with beef, which is, again, it's not really true.
Mm-hmm.
It's not correct. But the mashed potato topping is obligatory, of course, and when you think about the ingredients you get beef or lamb, carrots, you get vegetables, you get a delicious gravy, if you will, in there. It's just, that's another quintessential Irish dish, and I'm not sure who really came up with the idea of the mashed potato topping, but whoever did, it was, I think, a great invention.
It was certainly a great invention, right? And then in Colcannon, we get, the potatoes and the cabbage, and talk a little bit about that. I've talked about that before on the show, but it's been so long, we need another discussion on Colcannon.
Yes, Colcannon, was originally made with kale, which, of course, is now the darling of everyone's diet these days.
That's right.
who never ate kale before, have discovered through all kinds of, kale smoothies and whatever, that it is such a great, it has such great nutrients in it and so on. But it was originally made with kale. So if you were to make it now, boil the potatoes separately as if you were going to make mashed potatoes and cook the kale or the cabbage. A lot of people do still make it with cabbage. Boil that separately and just mix them together with a huge pat of butter, of course, and cream or milk. And it's basically just mashed potatoes with either cooked kale or cooked cabbage.
I mean,
also serves, as a wonderful side dish for any kind of meat, so it wouldn't necessarily have to be pork or lamb, anything. A steak.
That's right.
With people make it now with into potato cakes, Colcannon potato cakes, which are delicious. Boxty is another great Irish potato dish. That's made with half mashed and half grated raw potatoes. So it's a little bit like a latke, in that it's fried on a griddle. So there's so many great mashed potatoes dishes, and you can get at one meal, oftentimes, and I'm talking about, high-end restaurants also, that serve three different kinds of potatoes with your meal. Boiled, mashed, baked, those are called jacket potatoes, and maybe a little potato cake. So it's just probably the most popular
right.
and versatile ingredient in any particular dish.
So it's kind of the obligatory side dish, right?
Absolutely, yes, yes.
But the Colcannon to me, right, and the Colcannon to me is like the ultimate comfort food. It's got the
yes.
long-cooked cabbage and the flavors just all melding together. To me, that's it.
That's it. And a lot of people who say, I don't like cabbage, still like Colcannon.
Right.
Because it's not so, in your face. It's a very subtle combination of the potato and the cabbage, finely shredded, though.
Well, you did write a book on pub food as well, but Irish pub food, but something that has come to America from the Irish pubs is the black and tan, for better or for worse. Some people love it. Some people, you know, say, no, it shouldn't. You shouldn't make it. But the black and tan, however, is forever, you know, on our tavern menus, our pub menus. And explain, and we do think of that as being Irish. Explain what that is.
You mean the drink?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. Okay, because in my one of my cookbooks, I have a recipe for black and tan brownies.
Oh, I was going to say, cake. I've heard of the cakes as well, but I didn't see your brownie recipe. Yeah.
Yes.
But
yes.
Where it came from was,
drink,
was a drink.
Of course, is named for a very reviled group of British soldiers who wore black and tan uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a drink where made with ale on the bottom and Guinness on top. So, but when you pour the Guinness on top, you have to pour it over a spoon so that it doesn't, it gets a little diversion when it goes into the glass, so it will sit on top of the ale.
So you sort of froth it before you put it in the glass.
Yes,
there, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you just pour it gently, and they actually make little spoons that you can hang over your pint glass, and when you pour it, and then it as I say, the Guinness diverts and doesn't make a direct hit into the ale. Otherwise, it wouldn't separate like that.
Well, you know, all these foods, which now we relate to comfort food and they are truly Irish American in derivation. I mean, in actuality, the derivation might be on something Irish, but it really is Irish American cooking. And Irish cooking has gotten a pretty bad rap, or had a bad rap, over the past years. And you discovered firsthand about that. And we are going to talk about that when we come back after a short break. So stay tuned.
Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. When you mill whole grains, you get all three parts of the seed, the bran, the germ, and the endosperm. The endosperm is the main energy storage unit of the seed. That's where the growing plant gets its energy before it can start photosynthesizing and making its own. It makes up a huge portion of the grain, about 83%, and it's the main source that's used for white flour. When you make white flour, you get rid of the germ and the bran and just have the white endosperm left. It contains almost all the carbohydrates. It also contains protein and iron and some of the other B vitamins as well. It's kind of what you classically think of when you're thinking of flour. So all that's there when you're milling with whole grains. But when you mill with whole grains, you also get the bran, which is the kind of roughage and gives that's what gives that kind of color to it. Also gives you extra fiber that helps you to be regular. And you also get the germ, which adds the fat and the flavor, which we all like from whole grains. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Pour a drink for the dust and the dirt, and sing with me.
Hi, we're back, and we've been talking about St. Patrick's Day and parades and food, and my guest is Margaret Johnson, and she's an Irish-American cook and cookbook author. And Margaret, we talked about Colcannon coming from the British uniforms of the hated soldiers, and in fact, St. Patrick's
Day, that was the black and tan.
I mean, the black and tan, right? black and tan. Right?
Yes.
Get my cookies straight here.
That's okay.
it's interesting because St. Patrick's Day started. You know, the celebrations in America, the Irish who were here in America started so early. Well, and again, no surprise, because there were so many Irish, but also because we shared this, battle, if you will, against the British. And so it was sort of a natural celebration of celebrating your Irishness to combat the British strongholds. And it just amazes me that there are so many celebrations and parades across the country. And as I said, Ireland had for a long time a bad rap when it came to cuisine, fine cooking. And that has certainly turned a corner, as many of the famed chefs and restaurateurs from Ireland can attest to and our testimony to. And you first visited in 1984. Tell us a little bit about what you saw at that time, some of the changes that have occurred and your impressions of the food today.
Well, in 1984, I did not go seeking anything other than my Irish roots. Food was not on my list of things to do. I had my husband and my children. We had it as a family vacation, so we just did all sorts of touristic things. And again, food was not on my on my agenda. We ate, you know, fried fish, and the kids ate cheese toasties, which the equivalent to a grilled cheese sandwich, and what was presented to us, that's what we ate. And we did find a McDonald's in the middle of O'Connell Street in Dublin, so that actually made the trip for them. So it wasn't really initially part of my thought process. I was just an Irish-American going to Ireland. And it wasn't until maybe 5 or 6 years later that I became more and more involved in Irish things, Irish history, Irish literature, and so on. And then it finally dawned on me that maybe the things that I was reading about in terms of food was really striking a chord with people everywhere. They were beginning to talk more about the new Irish cuisine. I read it, and I can't actually remember what publications it was, but maybe a magazine like Irish American Magazine or something like that. So I thought, gee, I really want to, I don't want to say get on this bandwagon, but I want to maybe do something to promote this idea. So I thought, maybe I'll write a cookbook and I'll ask some chefs in Ireland if they'd like to help me prove to the American people that really there's more to Irish cooking than just a boiled potato, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So that's how I just then dove into it and investigated every possible aspect that I could. And that's how I became so interested in Irish food. And of note, I wrote my first Irish cookbook in 1992, and it was from recipes that were contributed by Irish chefs who were so happy to say, yes, Margaret, let me help you. Let me send you a recipe and basically tell people that this is what's going on now. So there were all sorts of wonderful recipes that although used traditional Irish ingredients, but just did a few new things to them, let's say, back in 1992. And it really wasn't until 1996 that Irish food was given any sense of credibility, and it was when Bon Appetit magazine, who used to do their special collector's editions every May, and they would devote the entire issue to the food of one country. And in 1996, they devoted it to Ireland. And that is really what put Ireland on the map and helped me actually start my cookbook career in the U.S. And it wasn't until the next year, I might add, 1997, when the first really glossy food and wine magazine was published in Ireland.
Yeah.
So 1997. And when you think about some of the food magazines, you know, that we have in the U.S., Gourmet was 75 years old.
Right.
You know? And so that's just how it evolved. And, you know, today, you know, you would be hard-pressed not to find fabulous food in the smallest places in Ireland.
Right.
Everybody's a foodie now. Everybody's
right.
A foodie, it seems.
Well, it's true. And they have, they do have a lot of wonderful culinary ambassadors who help to spread the word. And certainly Dorina Allen, who has been on the show several times.
Oh, right.
And
yes.
She's runs a wonderful school, the Ballymaloe, mm-hmm. with her daughter-in-law. And Claudia McKenna, she's been on with me too. She's, you know, we have all these people who, not to mention all the myriad chefs that are just doing wonderful things and are a wonderful advertisement for the things to be found there. You think of the dairy alone. I mean, the dairy is just fabulous. They have such a wealth of wonderful goods, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm only sorry that more Irish farmhouse cheeses cannot come to America or do not come to America. Some of them, you know, they're done in such small, they're produced in such small lots that they really, they couldn't. It wouldn't probably be cost effective for them to export them. But I mean, in Ireland, there now are, there must be 35, maybe even 40 really, really fabulous Irish farmhouse cheesemakers. And these are literally made on farms. I mean, it's not just a little catchphrase. So those things also are getting to be renowned worldwide. And in places in Europe, though, you'll find Irish cheese in France, and you'll find it in Germany and you know, other places where it's so much easier to export it. You know, it's just a little hop, skip, and a jump, really. But it's unfortunate we don't have more of it here.
Right.
I mean, we have Kerrygold cheeses, which are wonderful, but they're not really farmhouse cheeses.
Right.
But they're made in Ireland, of course, and a great example of what you can get in the dairy field.
Mm-hmm. Now, your books, I mean, you have 11 different books, but they're all on Irish food and the cooking of Ireland, and not really so much, as you say, you change a little the process, but they're Irish ingredients, so they're not, it's not Irish American cooking, correct?
No, it isn't really. No, not at all. And the tea book, the afternoon tea book, which is titled Tea and Crumpets, that was I wrote that because I had written 5 books with Chronicle Books in San Francisco, and they were kind of up against a wall in terms of Irish topics, and said to me, Margaret, I don't know if we can really, we have a market for any more Irish books, so why don't you think of something else? And I said, oh, that's really all I'm interested in is Irish cooking. I'm Irish American. I'm not going to write an Italian cookbook or a book on Thai cuisine. It's just not, you know, you can't reinvent yourself like that. So someone suggested, what about tea, afternoon tea? I mean, Irish are huge tea drinkers. So I thought if I wrote something on afternoon tea, I could incorporate Ireland and, you know, the great British traditions as well. So I did take a brief diversion in that regard, but then I went right back to Ireland after that. But the afternoon tea book is a very popular book, I have to admit, still quite well.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, it's just it's such a pleasure to hear you talk about so cheerfully about the food and your experiences. Do you still give tours and run it when to Ireland?
And I have to say no.
Okay.
I did one tour, and it was great. And we went, 8 women went. It just happened to be women, and we had a fabulous time. And it was so much work for me, to be honest with you. I just said, I don't think I'm ever going to do it again.
Oh.
And now that I've said that, of course, every time I do a presentation, someone says to me, do you lead a tour to Ireland, Margaret? And I go, oh, well, I did, but no. No, I think those days are over, too. There's so many. It's the competition for leading a tour is very, very difficult. You know, there's so many tour operators out there. And I like to do it my way, and I want to stay at the hotels I want to stay at. And sometimes that becomes a little cost prohibitive. So I think I'm just better off just going by myself or going with a friend and doing what I want to do.
Well, I'm happy that you shared your insights on the food in the country with us on the radio today. We can't make a tour. And people can read all about your books and you and your background on the irishcook.com, your website. So
yes, it's just Irish Cook, Linda.
Irish, not the.
It's just
okay,
irishcook.com.
Okay, irishcook.com.
Yes. Website.
Great. All right. Well, thanks again, and thank you for listening. And I'm sure that all of you will be putting on a little bit of green on March 17th and celebrating St. Patrick's Day. You've been listening to A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.